220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Nicole Weinstock.
And I'm Jared Dantzler. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with host Paul Rowland. He'll be speaking with Nick Buxton, the co-editor of the recently released book, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Shaping a Climate-Changed World. We'll get a preview of this show on the next 15 minutes as KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaks with Buxton and the Paris Accord on the Paris Accord and the U.S. military. That's KBOO's News in Depth. Tomorrow morning at 9, it's Radio EcoShock. At 11, on The Food Show, host Chris Teagle speaks with Matt Newell Ching about changes coming to SNAP eligibility at the beginning of 2016. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support and for making KBOO a reality. If you are not a member today, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night.
Good night, Jared.
Good night, Nicole.
Stay tuned for the Tuesday News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're joined now by Nick Buxton. He's the co-editor of the new book, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Shaping a Climate-Changed World. And I want to talk about the military and their carbon emissions in relation to the recent Paris Climate Agreement. I understand that the military is the largest emitter of fossil fuels. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the U.S. Pentagon, one of the things that's a little hard to know is exactly how much the military missions actually amount to, because they actually got an exemption in 1997 as a result of U.S. pressure to not be included in the reporting of greenhouse gas emissions. But in 2012, U.S. Congress did find out that the Pentagon is the single largest emitter of fossil fuels. And that's not a big surprise, because if you think like an F-16 jet uses in 1 hour the same petrol, same gas as a car would use generally in 3 years. And these are very oil-greedy machines that the U.S. military uses right around the globe.
How was this brought up in the lead up to the Paris Climate Agreement? Was it brought up?
No, I mean, it was not on the agenda. The only thing that has happened, though, is by U.S. actually becoming a signatory to the new Paris Agreement that's just been agreed, they were excluded up to now because they never signed the Kyoto Protocol. And there is a potential for people to start to say, we need to include military emissions, because they're no longer specifically excluded from the accounts. So there is now a moment to say, okay, how much do they contribute, and how do we start to tackle that?
And how will that happen? Does it have to be through Congress, or can it be an executive action?
As far as I know, I think it can just be an executive action. There's not an international agreement around that. So it's actually each government under the current approach is a voluntary approach and decides the sectors that get included. There's a kind of template. And so the U.S. could start to report on those things. So it could be an executive action. And I think it's going to be up to movements to say that we need to include that in the picture, along with the aviation and shipping. Because it is an executive action, it doesn't need to be stalled by Congress. But it will be used as another form of attack, for sure, on attempts to kind of move this forward, saying that this will affect American national security. But we really do need that kind of debate. People don't know that the U.S. has 800 military bases around the world. It's got a huge network of bases, and do we really need that for security? And is there evidence that currently this kind of projection of global power is actually producing more security? And all the evidence is that actually insecurity is getting worse and terrorism is getting worse. So we really need to kind of rethink of these things. And if we think how increasingly climate change is going to start to have impacts on many people around the world, making it desperate for more people in terms of climate change, on impact on agriculture, on water, and so on. We really need to free up resources to support communities to have real security, security of a house, security of water, security of a livelihood, and the ability to kind of cope with climate change impacts. And the vast amount of money that's spent on the military, it's actually $1.8 trillion each year. If we just invested like 10% of that and reduced that military expenditure by 10%, we'd have double what is currently on the table in terms of support for countries to adapt to climate change.
Could you say that again? $1.8 trillion is spent on the military?
Yeah, on global, it's a worldwide military expenditure. And that's a huge amount. In 1992, just after the end of the Cold War, it was almost half that. So it's massively grown in the last two decades. And it's the resources that really need to be spent on stopping climate, worsening climate change, to kind of retool our infrastructure and to help communities adapt to climate change, which is already happening.
Well, and from the way that climate change is talked about on the individual level, there's a lot of push for individuals to make changes in our lives. And while that is a great thing and we should all be consuming less, it seems from what you're saying that just taking one F-35 or F-16 out of the air does far more than any individual could possibly do.
Yeah, I think that's very clear. There's a lot of focus on kind of individual actions, and I think it's always good for anyone to do what they can in the situation they can. But in the end, it's going to involve structural change. If someone only form of transport is to be able to get a car to just get to work, and there isn't a good public transport system, then of course people's choices are affected by the infrastructure they have. And if huge amounts is going on the military, the single biggest emitter, to support a vast empire of bases, our small actions won't add up to much. And that's why we do need these structural changes, because without these structural changes, those individual choices don't really matter.
You talked about the 800 bases of the U.S. military worldwide. And in your book that's just come out, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Shaping a Climate-Changed World, John Vidal from The Guardian says that this book shows how the few intend to profit from climate change and how the many can stop it from happening. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that, how the corporate military-industrial complex plans to profit off of climate change.
Well, we looked at this really. One of the things you'll notice, and this really kind of brought about the book, is that increasingly we're hearing everyone talk about climate change as a security threat. Including, it's not just the CIA and the military that say that, but even kind of progressive politicians such as Bernie Sanders. They're all painting this as a national security issue. And our concern was that once you start to paint it as a national security issue, it turns the victims of climate change often into the threats, because then it's about refugees becoming threats to our national security. And that much of the military planning for this is looking at how failed states, how refugees, how insecure people could become a threat to U.S. security interests. And then we looked at the corporations, and many of them are painting a very similar picture, like Shell does these long-term plans, and they talk about a world of increasing scarcity and fighting for resources, and how do we make sure the corporation continues to profit in this insecure world. So we saw quite a lot of dovetailing between military strategies and corporate strategies, and our concern is that that's kind of painting a world of where corporations profit and the military controls the consequences, but who are we creating security for? And that's really, the book is about secure and the dispossessed. It's security for some and dispossession for many others. And there are corporations that are both like looking to how to profit from this, but also even looking to make money out of these opportunities. As land and agriculture become stressed, there are lots of hedge funds now looking at land as a really good thing to invest in, because there's going to be conflict over land, scarcity will lead to increase in prices. So there are actually land investment managers saying, actually, climate change is a good, could be a good thing for our books, because it's creating scarcity and that's an opportunity for profit. But who are the people who lose out in that is often the small peasants and small farmers who lose their land as land gets taken over by corporations. And people's ability to kind of fend for themselves is dramatically decreased. And that's a world that we don't want to move towards. So that's why the book also articulates alternatives about how do we regain control over land? How do we make sure it's meeting basic human rights, or people's rights to food and water, and not responding to this idea of profiting from a time of crisis? We've got an alternative, and we need to fight for that.
Wow, it's a really dystopian kind of future that you're describing. How close to reality is that?
Well, it's in some ways, it's already here. I mean, land grabbing around the world is increasing dramatically. We saw it in Paris, even as climate talks were taking place, this idea that that security had to dominate, but obviously after the terrorist attacks. But who were the people who got arrested were lots of many environmental campaigners and activists. So there is an increasing tendency to respond to crises with security issues. And that's already happening. But it doesn't have to be that way. And we also see that at times of crisis, actually, people tend to respond with the best of themselves. And we've seen that in times like disasters like Hurricane Katrina. You saw a kind of military going in and people being in desperate conditions in one of the richest countries in the world. But actually, if you went down to the communities, you found out that people were spotting who was an elderly neighbor in their street who needed rescuing, and were then making sure that everyone was being looked after. And some of the stories coming out of Katrina, which are not told, are the ones of where communities really got together to support each other, to get the help they needed, and then to rebuild together. So we definitely have an alternative to this dystopian picture, and it's one that plays into the hands of the military and corporations who want to profit, but it's not one that people want. And what we see is that crisis actually leads to us responding in a very different and positive way.
Yeah, I know, that's what I saw in New Orleans after Katrina as part of the Common Ground Collective. And you talk about alternatives to this kind of capitalist oligarchic takeover of resources that is currently underway. What do you see as the best alternatives and the ways that people are actually organizing those?
Well, you mentioned one there, and I think that the story I often think of is an example from the United States is what happened after Hurricane Sandy. There was a rather extraordinary moment when the hurricane hit New York, where the whole of Manhattan went black except for one building, Goldman Sachs, which was protected by huge sandbags and also a massive generator. So there was the kind of initial thing was one corporation. And the public sector has flooded the underground, the metro, and the hospitals were evacuated, but a corporation survives. But what was more interesting was what happened afterwards, because lots of movements across the city in Occupy Sandy, after the Occupy movement, at one point had something like 60,000 volunteers across the city distributing water, food, and responding in a really organized way and outdoing actually both the Red Cross and the U.S. federal and local government response. And it just showed actually that there is that real potential to get organized and to respond with solidarity. And that's just one example. But there are many examples. I was in Paris recently, and a lot of the small kind of organic farm, not just organic, but small-scale farming from around the world are really looking at how not only can they adapt to climate change, but how do they kind of do regenerative agriculture that keeps carbon in the soil and actually can be part of the solution, and both providing food for people and also tackling climate change at the same time.
And I just have to ask, even given these alternatives that you're talking about and the ways that people come together in reaction to crisis, is there any way that we will be able to keep climate emissions to 1.5 degrees increase without dismantling the military-industrial complex?
I don't think so. And it's not just the military-industrial complex. I think it's a whole response to climate change that depends on things like market mechanisms. A lot of what we've been hearing about Paris, those who say it was a positive agreement, is that it sends the right signal to the markets. The idea being that if we use market signals, what investors make, then that will lead to the kind of actions we need to take. But there's very little evidence that is happening, and it's certainly not happening on the scale and the speed that we need. The day after the Paris Agreement, India said it was still going to double its coal production, so not much of a market signal to them. So I really think it will require much more radical action. We've actually got really about 5 years to turn this around, and it's going to need much more. It's going to need much more dramatic intervention. And the U.S. did this actually back in the Second World War. Roosevelt pulled all the car manufacturers together and said to them, within 6 months, I want you to stop producing cars and start producing tanks. And within about 9 months, they had turned around an entire economy. And that was a crisis of national emergency at that time. We've got something which is now a global emergency. And yet we don't see that same willpower. We somehow think that signals by